We are about to begin Parshat Mishpatim, a parsha which focuses, like its name, on the laws within the Torah, the different monetary laws. Before we begin, I would like to dedicate our learning. There's a family that was participating in our learning. He used to attend steadily, and his wife attended Machon Orah, and both of them are Geirei Tzedek. They have children, and they did the difficult gear process in the face of many obstacles. They had no intention of becoming Gerim when they first came to Israel, and their story is a fantastic one, which we don't have the time to go through, how they decided ultimately to become Gerim. Now, both of them, unfortunately, are ill at home. He had an accident this week, and she's been at home also for a while now. So Hashem should send them both a refuah shlema. They should continue having nachas from their kids. They really, more people should know them, because they could really be role models for guys who finish Giyur here. They're a family that's really making every effort in the face of every obstacle to maintain the Torah and bring up their children in the way of Torah, and they're doing an amazing job. I had the good fortune of meeting them and their family only 2 weeks ago, and as usual, they're very, very impressive. Hashem should send them both a refuah shlema, and our learning tonight will dedicate to their refuah shlema. His name is Ephraim ben Sarah, and she is Rachel bat Sarah. So Hashem should send them both a speedy recovery. Our parsha really has many, many laws, and we'll try to do a quick overview and then review with a little bit more depth. The parsha begins with the laws of a Hebrew slave. If a person is sold into slavery, he's a thief, or there are two types of Hebrew slaves: a person who chooses to sell himself into slavery, or a person who incurs debt, he's stolen, and now he cannot pay back what he's stolen, and it amounts to the sum that he would serve as a slave for 6 years. He steals someone's car, he has whatever the case is, the courts catch him, and when it comes time to pay, he doesn't have with what to pay. So for the principal, he would be sold into slavery for 6 years, if that's what's necessary. And there are laws about how protected the slave has to be. The person who purchases him has to pay him the sum up front, and has to take care of his wife and children. It's really a welfare system. And he's given very good treatment as a slave. That's what the Torah demands. And the Torah tells us that the person who purchases him, if the slave, the Hebrew slave, was previously married, so then one of the things he owes his master is that at nights, the master could tell him, I want you to spend the nights with the different shifchot knaniyot, the non-Jewish women who are also servants in his home. So that's part of the service he owes the master, and he doesn't have much of a choice in the matter. The Torah tells us that there could be a situation that when the 6 years are up, he says, I want to stick around. Notice that the Torah isn't fantasizing. I mean, the Torah is telling us of a real situation that could occur. So when we think of a slave, we think of someone being beaten and someone getting horrible treatment. The Torah discusses all kinds of laws protecting the slave, and we see that the Torah even has to limit the slave. He shouldn't choose to be a slave his whole life. The Torah doesn't approve of it, but if he says, I prefer to continue in this position, so then he can. He is given a limited capacity to continue in that position. The Torah tells us that a person has the possibility of selling his daughter as a slave. And there, the Torah again, the Torah is even against forced marriages. Even though the Torah gives the father the capacity of marrying off his daughter at a young age, that was only to protect the daughter, and the same thing here. The idea over here was, if the father becomes impoverished and we're worried that the daughter is going to roam the streets without food, that she'll roll down into prostitution. So the Torah said the father is given the capacity to sell her, And the intent is, who's going to buy her? Someone who's wealthier than the father. And the hope is that he will either marry her himself or his child will marry her. He has a special mitzvah to marry that girl, either him or his son. And the Torah says if he marries her, then he has to give her treatment like every wife. And here we are revealed, what does a husband owe every wife? So the Torah says a husband has to feed his wife, he has to give her clothing, and he has to spend time with her. They have to live like husband and wife. And then the Torah continues and tells us laws of murder. The Torah tells us that if a person murders, then we take him, we give him the punishment he deserves. Even if he's a Kohen and he's in the middle of service, there's no way out. We have to do justice. The Torah expands on the laws of honoring one's parents and says that if one wounds a parent or curses a parent with God's name, he gets the death penalty, chenek and skila. The Torah tells us someone who kidnaps can also get the death penalty. The Torah then tells us what happens if one person wounds another person. And the Torah tells us the different forms of damage that we have to pay. We have to pay for the damage. We have to pay for the pain. We have to pay for the medical bills. And we have to pay for the unemployment. That's called nezek, tsar, sheves, ripui, boishes. These are the five parts of payment that a person who damages someone else has to pay. What happens if a person wounds his servant? So if he kills him, he could get the death penalty for killing his servant. Notice how much the Torah is protecting the slave. The Torah tells us now, this isn't even talking about a Jewish slave. This is if a person kills his non-Jewish slave, an Eved Kenani. Why do we call a non-Jewish slave an Eved Kenani? Because the first slave in the Torah was Kenan, Eved Avadim Yelechav. So that's the prototype for all slaves. So we call them all, anytime we speak about a non-Jewish slave, it's an Eved Kenani. Now what's an Eved Kenani? Let's say there's a person who's not Jewish, he lives in the land of Israel after we've taken over the land. And he decides that he can't make ends meet, he wants to sell himself into slavery. He'll give the money to his relatives, he'll send the money to his wife, he'll send his money, he can't afford the bills. Whatever the reason might be, he could sell himself into slavery. Let's say there's slave trade going on. So we are allowed to purchase slaves, but we are limited in what we may do with the slave. Firstly, a slave who's entered a Jewish home, so he's given an ultimatum. He's given 12 months to decide whether he wants to accept mitzvot like a woman. If he does, then he'll get circumcised and he'll go to mikvah and he'll be obligated to do mitzvot like a woman. If he does not want it, so then he has to know that by the end of 12 months we're going to have to give him onward to the nations. He won't be able to stay with us. Now you could understand this also morally. We believe a certain set of values. If he wants to be a part of a Jewish home, he has to subscribe to at least part of those values. He's not obligated to all of them, but to part of them he is. Now, by the same token, the Torah protects him. If a person kills his slave, he's going to get the death penalty. And there are more laws as we continue. We'll see different laws, not only in our parsha, in other parshiot, protecting the slave. So it wasn't so bad to be a slave. Meaning, it wasn't something a person would necessarily choose to do to himself, even though there were people who did. Nonetheless, if you're considering being sold a person who's a slave, ordinarily, the Torah even has to discuss there was a problem that slaves would run away from their masters in the hope that they could become a slave to a Jewish person because the treatment was so much better than they were getting anywhere else. So we'll see that. We'll get to that. The Torah discusses what happens if people cause a woman to miscarry. So then they have to pay. Again, this is part of damages. And here we have the famous ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, where the literal translation of the verse is if he took out someone's eye, you take out his eye. And we have on tradition that that's not the way it works. We don't take an eye for an eye. And this is one of the places that we see the strength of our tradition. You read the Torah simply, what does the Torah say? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot. And here the tradition tells us clearly not that way. Torah says a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound. You know, the simple translation is just that. And we say no. We say he pays for the damage he inflicted. If a person wounds his non-Jewish slave, his Eved Kenani, so then the Torah gives us, if he cuts off a finger, if he takes out an eye, he takes out a tooth, so then the slave goes free. He doesn't remain in slavery. So the master has to be pretty careful with that slave. The Talmud tells us that there were sometimes slaves who would trick the master. They'd say, I have a toothache, could you help me, could you take care of the tooth? And he'd try taking care of the tooth, and inadvertently he'd take out the tooth, and then the slave would laugh at him and go free. That was the halacha. That's what Torah says. The Torah then goes on to discuss our responsibility with our animals. So the Torah says if a person's animal gored someone to death, so then that animal gets stoned. We don't leave that animal around. And you can't eat the meat. So the Torah is basically telling the owner, you have to watch your ox, because on the one hand you might say, well, it's unusual for my ox to gore people. I walk with him in public domain all the time. On the other hand, if he gores, then you should know that you will have to pay for it. But from Chazal, it seems in their day and age it was uncommon for an ox to gore. You have an ox that's gored once, twice, three times, then the master is also going to get the death penalty at the hands of heaven. Because we say, wait a second, your ox did this already. You knew he was doing this. The Torah tells us that if he gored a non-Jewish slave, so then also there's a special tax the person who owns the ox has to pay. The Torah tells us a person is responsible for any form of damage that he places in public domain. So a person parks his car in the middle of the highway. A person has an oil leak and he's driving on the highway and oil is sputtering from his car and other cars are slicking on the road because of it. Halachically, even though he says, well, it's not mine. Whoever wants could take it. Torah says, doesn't interest us. That's called a bor b'rishus harabim. Someone who digs a pit in public domain, so he's making potential for other people to be harmed, he's responsible for that. Even if a person just walks by a sewer and takes off the cover. So he didn't make the pit. It was there all along. He just took the cover off. If someone's animal falls in, he has to pay. The Torah tells us the laws of Ashor Tam. If an animal pushes with his body or bites, it's all a form of inflicting damage purposefully on another ox. So then the Torah tells us the way we work it is that being that it's unusual for an ox to purposely inflict damage on another ox, he only has to pay half the damage. That's called chatzi nezek. He pays half the damage and he pays it up to the value of the ox that gored. Meaning if the ox that gored another ox was worth $100 and he gored an ox that's worth $1,000, so he should have to pay $500, half the damage. Yet we say he's limited. He pays migufo. He pays up to the value that he himself is worth. So this is a tax. Technically, the Torah says a person shouldn't be responsible for his ox goring another ox. Oxen don't usually gore. So if a person, let's say, has a tame dog, that dog never bites. So if one time it bites someone, we say he couldn't have anticipated it would have bitten someone. His whole life it didn't bite. There's a discussion in the Mishnah, what happens if a person owns a snake or he owns a lion? He takes a wild animal and he brings it up in his home, meaning from birth this wild animal was in his home. Do we say that a wild animal could ever be tamed? Meaning, could you, when you take the animal out of the jungle, could you take the jungle out of the animal? So that's a machlokas tanaim. It's a machlokas in the Mishnah. Even though you brought him up tamely in your home, is there ever this concept that you've tamed the serpent, that you've tamed the lion? So assuming that a dog, you have a tamed dog, so that would be just like the ox. If you can assume it's never biting anyone, and then one time it does, so then you have to pay half the damage. What happens if it's done it a few times already? So then the Torah says, once it's done it twice, you should have known it was doing it. Should have taken better care of your animal, you have to pay full damages. Then you can't say, well, my ox doesn't do it. So there's a discussion, machlokes in the Gemara, is it after twice or three times that you should have known? Okay, we have a special law in the Torah. If a person steals someone else's source of livelihood, he steals his ox, he steals his sheep. So ordinarily, a person has to pay double if he steals someone else's object. But with an ox and a sheep, there's a special halacha that says if the person slaughtered it or sold it, and then he's caught, he'll have to pay a special tax, 5 ox instead of the ox, and 4 sheep instead of the sheep. And here our sages tell us an interesting drasha. Chazal say that the reason he pays less for the sheep is because to take a sheep is more difficult than to take an ox. An ox, you pull along and you take him. A sheep, you got to carry him on your shoulders. He's trying to run away all the time, and it's difficult. So the Torah took into account the shame that the thief had. Here we see how much the Torah takes things into account. You'd say he's a thief. What do I care if he suffered shame? He shouldn't have done it. The Torah says we're taxing him. So for an ox, it's easier thievery. He'll pay 5 ox. For a sheep, he did have some shame in stealing the sheep because the sheep he had to carry on his shoulders and it's more difficult. So the Torah only taxes him to pay 4 sheep. Now here also we see the importance of allowing a person to make his living. The ox a person uses to plow his field. You stopped him from his work. The Torah says pay 5 ox instead of the oxen. And here we have another important halacha. The Torah says the halacha of machteres. If the person is digging a path to enter someone's home. So the guy wakes up in the middle of the night. He goes to his basement and he hears digging. And he's there just as the thief breaks into his house. And he sees the guy, and he doesn't know. Maybe he's going to kill him. If a thief comes in, he always assumes maybe the owner, the landlord's going to wake up. And if there'll be a fight, he's prepared to kill. Otherwise, he wouldn't have entered the situation. So the Torah tells us that if a person's at home and a thief walks into the house, he may kill him. Because you never know. Maybe he's going to kill you. If he entered your home, so we're working under the assumption that he knew that you might put up a fight. He knew you're not just going to let him walk off with his money. And he took into account that if you wake up, he'll kill you. So the Torah says that's the law of machteres. A person's dug into someone else's home. If you catch him there, so again, we're not learning halachos now, but there is this concept of machteres that there can be times where the Torah says kill him. You don't have to think twice because he's going to kill you. The Torah says what happens if it's clear as day that he's not coming to kill you. Let's say it's a son and he sees it's his father who's coming to steal from him. So then the son could know that his father would never kill him. Even if he'd catch him, he wouldn't have killed him. If a father sees his son breaking into his home, he can't be as sure. But a son could be confident that his father wouldn't kill him. So then he's not allowed to kill him. He's not allowed to shoot him. He's not allowed to shoot him. The same thing would be if he calls the police in, or there's a way of calling in the neighbors. If he has other people present, so he knows the guy wouldn't pounce him and kill him, the guy would just run away, so then he can't kill him. Again, there's a lot to discuss. What happens if the thief is on his way out? Then what? Who said you could kill him just to save your money? Here we're talking about he's on his way in, so he's obviously interested in taking your money, and if you put up a fight, he's capable of killing the person. What happens when he's on his way out? So there are a lot of halachot that we're not discussing here, and all of this, of course, one has to learn the halachos, and we have to find out what's applicable today or not. But the concept exists in the Torah. Practical applications. So you have to find a class in halacha that could give you practical applications if and when we can apply it nowadays. The Torah then tells us if a person's animal goes into someone else's field and consumes or steps over someone else's field. You have a dog, he goes over to the neighbors and eats off their prized roses or their prized daisies. Or he just steps all over their garden patch. So then the Torah says you have to pay. And you have to pay from the best of your crops. You have to pay him top dollar. There's no leniency. A person has to watch his animals. What happens if a person made a barbecue and the fire spread out and started burning someone else's house or someone else's objects? So Torah says he has to pay for it. A person is responsible to watch a fire that he lights. What happens then? The Torah tells us the laws of shomrim. A person gives someone else an object to watch, and then it gets stolen. So the Torah says we're concerned maybe the guy stole it himself. So there's a special Shavua d'Oraisa. The Torah says the person has to take a vow that he didn't steal it. And this is one of the three Shavuot d'Oraita, right? We have three times the Torah says biblically one must take a vow. And they are Rashi Tevot Shema. Shin is Shomrim, that's this. Mem is Modeh B'Miktzat. And Ayin is Ed Echad. Modeh B'Miktzat is if I come to Daniel and I say, you owe me $1 million. Daniel says, I don't owe you $1 million. I only owe you $750,000. So the Torah says Daniel has to take a vow. Once he admits to part of the claim, so then he has to take a vow that he doesn't owe the rest of it. That's Modeh B'Miktzat. And Shvuat Ed Echad is if we bring one witness. Ordinarily, we need two witnesses to validate anything. The Torah says if one witness testifies against the person, then he has to take a vow against that witness. Okay. Torah tells us if he was paid for watching the object, then he's responsible to pay if it was stolen. That's what you're being paid for. If a person borrowed something from someone, then he has more responsibility. The Torah then goes into all kinds of laws of if there's a witch or a person who performs animism, he lives with an animal, so they get the death penalty. If a person seduces a girl, so then the Torah says she has the choice to force him to marry her. She could say, you encouraged me to do this, to live with you like husband and wife. She was a young girl. So the Torah says she has the choice to insist that he remain her husband, or he'll pay a tax. She chooses. The Torah gives us a special commandment to treat gerim properly, to treat gerim nicely. And with it, the Torah tells us to be careful with those that are weak in society, the widows, the orphans, that a person shouldn't afflict them. We have a special prohibition against afflicting someone verbally. That's why someone once did a practical joke on me. So I didn't take it seriously. So he said to me, couldn't you give me the satisfaction of having at least 1 second that you fell for it? So I told him, if I would have really fallen for it for a second, then you would have transgressed for that second. Now, Halacha says that if you hurt someone, even though you were just joking, but at the end of the day, you hurt someone, that's a biblical prohibition. You're not allowed to hurt someone verbally. And we have a special prohibition against hurting a ger with the words we say, or an almana, or a yatom. And God says, if you do afflict them, God says, I'm listening. They weep at night, and when they yell, I listen. And then God says, those who afflict them, I'll make their wives widows and their children orphans. Then we have the mitzvah in Kesef Talviyat Tami. Oh, we just learned all the Abad Chesed, the first six chapters of the mitzvah of giving a loan. So we learned about who gets precedence, and the person, if he's a poor person and he comes and asks for a loan, so he also has precedence over a rich person. And the Torah teaches us that we're supposed to treat him as an equal. And we have a special mitzvah, Lo Tielo Kenoshe. Don't come and tell him, you owe me and pay me and be tough with him. You know he doesn't have money, so don't be tough with him. We have a special prohibition against collecting interest. And the Torah tells us, let's say the collateral you took is something he needs. You took his cover. So every night, give it back. He has to have it back by nightfall. God says you don't give it back to him, so he has to sleep without a cover. I know when he'll cry to me, God says, I'll listen. We have a special mitzvah not to curse the leaders. Think about that. What do people spend their time doing? Talking about the politicians. So the Torah gives us a special prohibition against cursing the leaders, cursing the judges. The Torah tells us we have to pay our taxes on time. We have to pay the truma we have to give on time. And we have to take the firstborn, and the firstborn child, we have pidyon haben. We give money instead to the kohen who's representing God. And we have a special mitzvah that on the eighth day, the animals are fit for karban. The Torah then gives us a commandment, v'anshei kodesh tiyuni, be holy. We have to be holy in what we eat. A holy person, everything he does is holy, but that's represented in the things that are more animalistic. You have to eat, right? You can't live without eating. God made us of material and spiritual. So the material part of us has to eat. So on that, the Torah says, fine, when you do the material things, do them holy. Where do you find the person that's holy? The way he goes to the bathroom, the way he eats, the way he sleeps, the way he is with his wife. That's how you measure a person's holiness. I'll give you guys an interesting short piece of homework. Open up the Rambam on Kedusha and see which laws are in Kedusha. You'll see there are only three things in Kedusha. What's included in the concept of Kedusha? The Rambam wrote 14 books. The Yad HaChazaka, Yad is Gematria 14. He wrote 14 books encompassing all of Jewish law. One of those books is called Kedusha, holiness. What three things does the Rambam discuss there? So that's you guys' homework. I never give homework here, so now you have one piece of homework. I think it's the first time in years. Okay, Vanche Kodesh Tiyunli. You guys always give me homework, though. But Vanche Kodesh Tiyunli. What? Wasn't the Kama. Vanche Kodesh Tiyunli. So the Torah says be holy, and that's reference to being careful about what we eat. Torah tells us we're prohibited from taking false vows or joining the masses when they do evil. And the Torah warns the judges to be fair, not to take the side of the poor. We have to judge fairly. Justice has to be justice. We have a special mitzvah of Ashavas Aveda. You encounter something that someone lost, so the Torah says you have to give it back. The Torah says if you find the ox of your enemy, so Chazal say, who is a person's enemy? That's when you see a person, he's sinning in broad daylight. The guy, everyone knows on Shabbos, you're not allowed to work. He opens his store. He's not embarrassed. Then you see him riding on his donkey, and his donkey's suffering under the load. The Torah says, go help him. The poor donkey, you can't let that donkey suffer. You say, I can't stand the guy. He's a sinner. The guy, he owns the condominiums, and he's raising rent exorbitantly. He's taking advantage of the fact that the poor can't fight him legally. He's not taking care of their apartments, the things he promises them he doesn't do. He doesn't fix their leaks. He's not fair to them. But he has contacts on the board, and he's not worried about the law because all the judges are in his pocket. And he's unfair. He's unfair in his business practices, and everyone knows it. So the Torah says, yeah, you're allowed to hate a person like that. A person who's an open sinner, you're allowed to hate him. But when you see his donkey suffering under the load, Torah says, help him out. Here we have the mitzvah of Tzar Ba'alei Chaim, that we have to care for the pain of every living creature, any animal or human being that's suffering, we have to care about. So the Torah says, even though he's a sinner, help him unload the donkey. What happens if he sits back and says, hey buddy, you got a mitzvah. You unload the donkey. I'm sitting in the shade. I'll be okay. So then Torah says, Azov tazov imo, with him. If he joins you and helps you unload the donkey, then you unload the donkey. If he does not, then you leave the donkey and let him deal with his donkey. We're up to Chamishi. The Torah warns us to be careful, to stay away from lies with regard to monetary issues. The Torah warns us against using the courts to kill people that don't deserve the death penalty. And from here we derive a very interesting halacha. Let's say a person was judged in the courts, and don't forget, in order to get the death penalty in Judaism, the scenario has to be that there are two kosher witnesses present, and they warn him, don't do this act, because if you do it, you'll get the death penalty. And he says, I don't care, and he does it. So it's not so common that you get a guy who's going to get the death penalty in Judaism. I mean, how often do you have someone's there when he's sinning? Even the Chilul Shabbos. A guy's going to do something that's a desecration of Shabbos. Even, let's say, he's driving. So you want to be a smart aleck. You run after his car and you say, don't push the gas pedal. But you have to finish the sentence. Because if you do, then the Torah says the prohibition. You have to quote the prohibition. And you will get, and you have to quote the punishment he'll get. What are the chances he'll finish that sentence while he's within earshot? So it's uncommon. It didn't happen frequently that people would get the death penalty. But the Torah tells us that we cannot use the death penalty as a way of killing off people. And if we've come to the conclusion that someone deserves the death penalty, and they're on the way to take him to the gallows, and someone says, you know what, I just realized there's a way we could say he was okay, I have a claim in his merit, we stop the procession and we open the case all over again. The halacha says, as many times as someone's there that says, I have room to find him innocent, I have room to free him from the death penalty, every time we'll take him back. Torah says, don't kill someone who's innocent, and we say that's going to teach us even this. Let's say a guy was in court, and the court rules he doesn't get punished. And then someone yells, wait, just after the ruling, he says, I realized I have a way of implicating him. I have a way of indicting him. Let's reopen the case. He does deserve the death penalty. Torah says, no. You don't reopen the case. The Torah says, you don't kill a person that's already been found innocent. If he's been found guilty, you'll reopen the case as many times as it's possible. Anytime there's room to find him innocent. But if he's been found innocent, you don't reopen the case. The Torah again prohibits us from taking bribes, and we know that bribes are not only in the form of money, bribes are also in the form of words that are said and actions that are done. The Talmud gives us many stories explaining this point, where one rabbi was about to cross a river and someone came and gave him a hand, and then after he crossed the river he asked him, what do you want? So the guy said, I need you to judge me in a case, and he says, I can't, I've already accepted a bribe. All kinds of things like that. The Talmud gives us many, many stories of how careful the rabbis were not to take anything that could be close to a bribe, because it causes a person to, it slants a person's vision. Again, the Torah warns us not to oppress the ger. The Torah warns us time and again. And why does the Torah keep warning us not to do that? Because he has a more difficult yetzer hara. It is easier for him to be seduced. And once he goes off the path, it's so much harder to bring him back. Someone who grew up, he knows he's Jewish. He's always been Jewish. It's a question of more observant or less observant. So there it's easier to bring him back. But a ger, he has his whole past. He has all the people that he knew. And all his former family and all of them, they're not Jewish. If he chooses to leave, he's got everywhere to go, and it's much harder to bring him back. So the Torah warns us time and again, be careful, because a ger is so easily turned off. It's so easy to turn a ger off. And the Torah says, be careful. We have many places where the Torah warns us, more than once in our parsha alone. So this is one of the concepts that we have to understand, because today it applies not only to ger. If we say the concept of shesuro ra, that the Torah warns us about a ger because he's so easily turned off and he's got where to go, if that's what suro ra means, well, today you have whole communities that are non-observant. Anyone that's turned off has got everywhere to go. So we have to be so careful with anyone that did tshuva and he's got a former family and he's got places to go. It's difficult. He's lived a different life. The Yetzer Hara is much more difficult. And he also always feels like he's got where to go. Okay, if you guys think I'm wrong, fine. There are other people who think I'm right. So that's pshat in Suro Ra, it would apply not only to a ger. The Torah tells us we have 6 years to plant our fields and collect the crops. And on the seventh year we let go. We leave the field for the poor. The poor and the wild animals, and we do that with our crops, with our orchards, and the Torah connects it with the commandment of Shabbos. And on Shabbos, we let our animals rest, so that our mind is not focused on them, our animals aren't working on Shabbos, and also our servants. The Torah then tells us, "Uvechol asher amarti alechem tishameru," watch everything I've told you. And here we have a warning that encompasses all of the Torah. We know the word shamor is watch, is a losase. Here the Torah gives a warning, watch over the all of the Torah. V'shem Elohim achirim lo tazkiru, don't mention other idols, don't mention what other people worship. And this applies not to say, I'll meet you across from that church. I'll meet you, people don't even like saying San Simon. People don't like saying anything that has that's used as idol worship, we don't even mention it. That's why the Talmud changes the names. The Torah changes the names of the idols. We call it one after another, we say Markulis. We change, it was called Balkulis. One after another, we change the names. We call them Ovdei Gilulim. What are Gilulim? Gilulim are feces. We say they worship feces. We don't say the idol they worship. The Torah tells us, don't mention their names. That's why some people don't like using Thursday. What is Thursday? Oh. So the days of the week. That's why you have people who are careful to say Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni. Yeah. The day of Thor, the god Thor. That's okay, I don't either. Okay. So the Torah says we have to be careful. This includes the prohibition not to cause others to swear by other gods. And that's why our sages encouraged a person that his partners should be Jewish, because if he makes a partnership with a non-Jew, so then they'll have to go to court. And when he takes a vow, what's he going to take a vow by? He'll swear by Jesus Christ. Okay, what's he saying when he's saying that? He's saying what the Torah just said. Don't mention those names. So when the Torah gives us prohibition, the Torah says, Lo yishama al picha, it shouldn't be heard on your lips. And the Torah is going to include not only on your lips, but don't cause other people to say it. The Torah tells us the commandment of Shalosh Regalim. We have three festivals, three times that we celebrate. We have the Yom Tov of Pesach, which the Torah calls Chag HaMatzos, right? The Torah refers to it as Chag HaMatzos, the time when we make the matzos. There's a beautiful Hasidish word on that. We call it Chag HaPesach. We say that's the time God passed over us. We stress what God did for us. And God calls it Chag HaMatzos. That's the Yom Tov where you guys went out with only matzos to eat. God calls it by the name of our valor, the beautiful things that we did, that we went out with only matzos, and we bake matzos in honor of this Yom Tov. So God calls it Chag HaMatzos. We have the mitzvah on this day to eat. On the first day we have a mitzvah to eat matzos. And the Yom Tov of Chag HaMatzos has to be Limo'et Chodesh Aviv, in the spring months. And from here we derive the concept of a leap year. That we, in the Jewish calendar, even though it's a lunar calendar, and the lunar month is 20... How many days is... How many days is the lunar month? 29 and a half days. So if we didn't interject the lunar month, we would... the lunar month is 584 days, right? So we're short 354, I'm sorry, what did I just say? 354 days. So we're short 11 days a year from the 365.
719,
so we add a leap year. We add leap years to ensure that Pesach always falls out in the spring months. That's what it says in our parsha. Pesach has to fall in the spring month because in the spring you left Egypt, and that's part of what we commemorate on Pesach. We have a mitzvah, lo yeru fanai reikam. Don't show up to God empty-handed. So this is a mitzvah with regard to God. That when we come to the temple, we bring a gift, we bring a sacrifice. We have olat re'iya. An ola sacrifice that's in honor of the fact that we merit to see God's face. In the time of the prophets, it was continued that when people came to see the prophet, so they'd always bring him a gift. The prophet is a representative of God. They'd always bring a gift when they came to the prophet. The Torah then tells us the Yom Tov of Shavuos. That's the holiday of the harvest, and that's the what we call Shavuot. And then we have the third holiday, Chag HaAsif. Notice that here, the Torah tells us the holiday is based on the seasons. That's what the Torah is stressing over here. That's what we just discussed, the mitzvah of having a leap year. On these three holidays, we have a mitzvah of Leraot, to be seen by God. The Torah tells us we have a mitzvah of Bikurim, bring the first fruits when you come to the temple. And then we hit Shishi, lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, don't cook a goat with its mother's milk, which we know is the source for the biblical prohibition of eating meat with milk or cooking meat with milk or deriving any benefit from meat with milk. So that would be part of the reason. There are a few reasons why a person couldn't own a McDonald's. One of the reasons is because you're not even allowed to have you're not allowed to cook, so you can't have a hamburger, a cheeseburger, because you're not allowed to cook meat with milk, and one's also not allowed to derive benefit from it. There are other reasons why you can't own a McDonald's, but why a Jew can't own a McDonald's. But now we've encountered two. Okay, we've hit Shishi. Got, yeah.
What about stocks?
Oh, good question. So you'll have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi. We're not doing halacha here. We're learning the parsha. What? In Israel, there's kosher McDonald's. Fine. I don't know. If you say so, I don't know. Never been there. I don't know. God says, I'm sending an angel to lead you to the place I've chosen, to the land of Israel. Be careful to listen to him. Moshe is going to request, God, no, we want you. We don't want your angel. And ultimately, that angel will come back in Yeshua's time, and he will lead us to the victories, to conquering the city of Jericho, etc. And God says, serve me. Don't serve all the pagan gods that you'll encounter, the different nations are serving in Israel, but serve me. People think they serve the moon, they serve the sun. Look, the sun gives us crops, the moon blesses our water. God says, you serve me and you got it all covered. I'll bless your bread, I'll bless your milk, I'll bless your water, and I'll remove all illness from within you. Your women won't miscarry, I'll give you longevity. I'll take care of the nation that's there in the land of Israel. They'll be so scared of you, I'll make them all run away. I'll send before you this special flea called the tzirah that will spritch, it'll send its venom in their eyes and castrate them below. And they'll run away just from the plague of this tzirah fly that'll attack. I won't let you conquer the land of Israel so quickly that in 1 year you'll get it all, because then the land will be desolate and you'll have many wild animals roaming the land. I'll let you conquer it slowly so that you can slowly settle the land. And your borders will expand from the Yam Suf to the Philistine Sea, from the desert to the river. I'll let you conquer the whole land and chase them out. But don't make a peace treaty with them. Don't make a peace treaty with them or their gods. They can't stick around, because all they'll do is cause you to sin to me. You'll ultimately devolve to serving their pagan gods, and that will be a stumbling block from you. Now you, Moshe, you come up to me, you, Aaron, Nadav, Avihu, and the elders, and you'll bow from afar. Moshe will come up, and they'll stand from afar. And then they'll count 40 days that Moshe is up at the top of Mount Sinai. Now Moshe comes back, tells the Jews the laws of Hashem, and the Jews say, we'll do whatever God says. Moshe writes down the words, he builds an altar, he sets up stones corresponding to the 12 tribes, they bring sacrifices, and now we have the gear process. At the end of Parshas Mishpatim, we encounter the first gear process. The Jews have learned what Judaism is about, they have purified themselves, they've gone to mikveh, and they're bringing the sacrifices of the gerut, and all of Am Yisrael is accepting all of the mitzvot. They say, Naseh v'nishma. So, in front of the heavenly courts, they're accepting the mitzvot, they're bringing the sacrifice of gerim, and from here we learn the laws of gerut. How do you become a ger? You need mikveh. You need the sacrifice. Nowadays, we don't have that possibility, so the Talmud questions and comes to the conclusion that one can become a ger even without the sacrifice. But when the temple will be rebuilt, all the gerim will have to bring the sacrifice. So they're on hold till the temple will be rebuilt. And one has to accept the mitzvot before the courts, and also do a circumcision for Lashem Giyu. And Moshe sprinkles the blood towards the nation, and he goes up towards Hashem, and they see a heavenly vision. The elders, they look, and really they should have gotten the death penalty for looking towards God when God appeared. They didn't. God was going to wait. Ultimately, they'll be punished later. God tells Moshe, come up the mountain. I want to give you the Luchos, the Torah, the Oral Law, the Prophets, the Talmud, the Gemara. All of the Torah I'm going to give you, the Written Law and the Oral Law. And all of the Oral Law and all of the Prophets were really given to Moshe. Moshe summed it up. The Torah really includes everything that it says in the Prophets. And in the Oral Law that Moshe gave over is included all of the Mishnah and the Talmud. They had it on tradition. It wasn't an invention of the Talmudic times. It was something that they had on tradition from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. They had Mishnah and they had Gemara. We even have Braisos that go back to Moshe Rabbeinu. We have a Braisa Demleches HaMishkan, Braisa of how to build the Mishkan that Moshe was taught when he was up in heaven. A Braisa about how to build the Beis HaMikdash. And we also have Mishnayot that date back to Moshe Rabbeinu's time. The chapter of Ezeu Mekoman is a chapter that goes all the way back to Moshe. The chapter of Ezeu Mekoman, what we say in Korbanos every morning, that's a chapter that the whole chapter verbatim was given, was Allah all the way back to Moshe. There's no machlokas in that chapter. That's a tradition from the time of Moshe. Moshe appoints the elders and Aaron and Hur, and he says, whoever has a question, come to them. So Hur was Miriam's son. He was their nephew. Miriam married Kalev, and they had this son, Hur. And Moshe tells them, whoever has a question should ask them. And Moshe goes up the mountain, and there a mountain settles on the mountain, and Moshe spends 6 days without eating anything, and in those 6 days he's preparing to go up towards God. And then God on the seventh day calls out to him, and he comes up the mountain. He comes up to Hashem. Did Moshe go up to heaven? Did Moshe stay at the top of the mountain? So when you learn the Gemara in Sukkah, you'll see what the Gemara says about that. And Moshe stays there for 40 days and 40 nights. Later on, Moshe is going to testify, I didn't eat or drink anything during the time I was up in heaven. He becomes angel-like. The Jews down below, they start blowing shofar every day. They're going to count 40 days that Moshe went up the mountain. So the first time they count 40, we know they started on the day Moshe went up. They should have started the next day. And so their count is off. They're going to hit the end of 40 and they're going to think he should have come down. And on that day, and they're going to err. And that's why the next time Moshe goes up, they blow shofar every morning and they say, today is day this to the count, today is day this to the count, to ensure that they don't err the second time, the last time he goes up. And that's why we, in commemoration of that, we also blow shofar in the month of Elul, in commemoration of that last time that Moshe went up, and they blew shofar and declared every morning, this is the number of days since Moshe went up. So they were counting their 40 days. So that's the conclusion of the parsha. So we tried to go through the parsha quickly with a little bit of explanation, and now maybe we'll expand on a few mitzvot in the parsha. As you see, the parsha is loaded. It's a good idea if you have extra time to take the Sefer Mitzvot HaKatzar of the Chafetz Chaim and see some of these mitzvot so you familiarize yourself with them. In our parsha, we are given God's legal system. Ve'la mishpatim. These are the legal systems that God gave us. And it comes straight off of the commandment, don't go up to the altar with steps. Go up a ramp. And these are the laws. And this is the justice system that God says. Notice the parsha begins with the vav. Ve, and these are. What's the connection? Just like you don't go up to the altar on steps, where each step you go up a substantial amount, but rather you go up a ramp, in which a ramp slowly goes upward. The elevation is straight. Slowly it's heading up. So too when a person comes to judge, a person shouldn't be swift. He has to slowly go work his way to the conclusion. And from here we also derive that just like all the commandments we read about in the last week's parsha were at Sinai, so too these were at Sinai. Ve'ela mishpatim, and these are the laws. This is the justice system you should place before them. Ve'ela mishpatim, and these are the laws. We concluded with v'lo talev ma'alot al mizbechi, don't go up steps to the altar, and these are the laws. From here we derive that the laws, the center, the high court, so to speak, the central nervous system for the legal system is by the altar. Up in the Beit HaMikdash, we have the Lishkat HaGazit. That is where the high court is to be situated. The Ela Mishpatim, these are the laws, and they have to be placed near the Mizbechi, near the altar. Asher Tasim Lifneihem, place these laws before them. From here we derive that a rabbi has to teach his students warmly. He has to look at them in a way that is inviting, that they should be happy to learn before him. Asher tasim lifnehem, place it before them. Lifnehem, give them panim, that they're going to want to learn. Our sages say, if you see a student that is unsuccessful in his learning, one of the reasons might be, you could assume his rabbi is teaching him when he's pressured, his rabbi is teaching him and he's not looking at him fondly. Part of what a rabbi has to do in his teaching is to place it before them, place it in a way that they'll feel comfortable learning. Asher tasim lifnehem, you place these laws before them. Them, our sages say, is a reference to men and women. From here, the Torah taught us equality, that men and women, when it comes to monetary laws, they are treated equal. And if you analyze this and compare it to the laws, the legal systems of the time, you'll see that the Torah was, there was no legal system that was similar to this for centuries before it and centuries after it. The Torah here tells us, lifnehim, before them, men, women, they are all given monetary rights. In Judaism, a woman can own land, a woman has monetary rights like a man. Asher tasim lifnehim, these laws are placed before them, before judges that are masters of the law. A person has to have a tradition in order to be fitting to be a judge. And we've lost a part of that tradition today, and that's why we're limited today as to what our justice system, our Jewish justice system can judge. In telling us that the justice system must be before them, the Torah is telling us a few things. Firstly, the Torah is telling us a person has to go to a Jewish court. There's a prohibition against going to a non-Jewish court. And there are batei dinim, there are Jewish courts around. And even if your issue is with a company, you could sue them in a Jewish court. And that's what a person should do. If they don't want to go to a Jewish court, then the Jewish courts can give you a letter giving you permission to use a non-Jewish court. But a person must begin within a Jewish court. If one is dealing with corporations, he should consult his local Orthodox rabbi, because with regard to corporations, there's a discussion whether Judaism recognizes the existence of a corporation. Meaning a corporation is a fictitious entity. Yeah, the Torah holds us obligated for our actions. But let's say a person makes a deal between his company and the other company. So in the legal system, there's capacity for Chapter 11. A person can say, my company can't pay. In the Torah, you're responsible for whatever you do. The question is, how do we apply this concept of a corporation? And there's another question, if we sign all our contracts with lawyers and we use everything we're doing is based on the legal jargon of the country we're living in and with those understandings in mind, so how do we apply that? Meaning, we didn't check out what the halach says about it. I assumed I was hiding behind my corporation. So all of this has to be discussed with one's local Orthodox rabbi. Asher tasim lifnehem, that you place before them. Here Chazal teaches a very important concept. En ladayan el mashin avrot. The judge only knows what he sees. We don't hold him accountable if he judges differently than what he sees. Hey, if he judges based on what he sees and the facts are different than what he sees. He has to do his best to verify, but at the end of the day, he's not responsible for knowing beyond what he sees. People sometimes come to their local Orthodox rabbi, they give him half a story, and they expect him to give them an answer. And that's wrong. He could only give you an answer based on what you tell him. Even the judges in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu were taught this rule. En ladayan elama she'inav ro'ot. The judge only knows what his eyes see. So he has to judge based on what he sees, and so to speak, this is limited liability. The Torah says, you do your best, but at the end of the day, you're not responsible to be perfect. You're responsible to do your best, given the facts that you're given. Our sages used to try to distance themselves from being judges. They were very scared. It's a tremendous responsibility. On the other hand, they taught that whoever does judge correctly is a partner with God in creation. And if he does it the way he should, then God helps him that he shouldn't err. That's why the Torah gives us the mitzvah of Edim Zomimim. You guys know the mitzvah of Edim Zomimim. We don't have time to go into it today. It's not our parsha, so a different time we'll discuss it. The Torah tells us to go by the majority opinion, because God is with the Beis Din, and there's greater reason to believe that the majority will not err. Okay. The parsha really enumerates details of the Ten Commandments. Meaning, after the Aseres HaDibros, the Torah gave greater detail to the Aseres HaDibros. We said that the Ten Commandments are really an encapsulation of the 613 mitzvot. So, God says, I am Hashem your God. Corresponding to that, Hashem expands. And then the last week's parsha, Atem Reitem, you saw that I spoke to you from heavens. You saw I'm running the show. God says, Lo Yelecha, the second commandment is one's not allowed to have any other being that he has faith in. God says, Lo Tasuniti, God says, you saw I was the only one. Don't make yourself any idols together with me. Serve me solely. Now in our parsha, the parsha begins, Ve'la Mishpatim, these are the laws. This is really giving us details of Lo Tachmod, we're prohibited from desiring something that is we have no right to. Well, how do I know what I have a right to and what I don't have a right to? So our parsha explains to us what we have a right to. Then the Torah tells us the laws of a Hebrew slave. And this mitzvah has all kinds of secrets to it. It is corresponding to the mitzvah of Shabbos. And we know that the slave is doing something that's the antithesis of what the Torah wanted. The Torah wanted us to be free men fulfilling the Torah. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim and said, you are my servants, and this guy chose to go into slavery. That's not what the Torah wanted. The piercing of the ears, so pierced ears are things that slaves have. And our sages say that the pierced ear was because he heard with his ear that God declared, you are my servants. The Jewish people put the blood on the doorpost and on the door, and then God passed over their home and declared, you are my servant now. I am taking you out of slavery. So that ear that heard, so to speak, that declaration and said, I still want to be a slave. So that gets pierced with an awl that's called a marzea in Hebrew. Marzea is the gematria of 400. Danny, you could do the math. I did it. It's easy, man. Okay. The Torah tells us that an Eved Kenani goes free b'shein v'ayin if his tooth gets knocked out or his eye gets knocked out. Oh, Marzeh is 400. We were supposed to be in slavery. I forgot. Thank you. We were supposed to be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years, and God shortened that bondage. This guy says, well, I still want to be a slave longer. So then his ear gets pierced with the Marzeah that has the numerical value of 400. He's, so to speak, saying, oh, God, you took us out too early. I could have used more time where someone else was responsible for everything in my life. An Eved Kenani goes out with Shen V'ayin. You guys remember what did Kenan do improperly? He saw his father's nakedness. He stood there and looked at his father's nakedness, and then they went out and spoke about it. So he sinned with his mouth and his eyes. And that's why the Torah gives those examples as things that Eved Kenani would go free. If his eye gets knocked out, if his tooth gets knocked out, so then we say he's already gotten punishment enough and he goes free. After the mitzvah of a slave, so the Torah tells us the mitzvah of Lo Tirzach. That's, we're going on in the Ten Commandments, right? Lo Tirzach, he shall not murder. So the Torah tells us if a person did murder, we take him even from atop the altar, even if he's a coin. Then the Torah told us, we have to honor our parents. So here the Torah tells us one is prohibited from cursing one's parent. One is prohibited from wounding them. If the parent needs medical treatment, one should get a different doctor to deal with them if he could give them treatment as good as himself. A person should preferably not treat his own parents, because even though anything you're doing for their benefit is permitted, but we're always concerned. Maybe a person will let a drop more blood than is necessary. And this is not only with regard to a parent, this is every doctor has to be extra careful. In order for a person to be a doctor, he has to know he's responsible to give the best possible treatment to the patient. The Torah permits one to be a doctor with that understanding, that he is the best doctor that could be, and he's giving the best treatment that could be. And if he causes the patient to bleed a drop more than he has to, in that moment he is transgressing. Now, a person can't be perfect, but he's held accountable to be as perfect as possible. The Torah warns us not to serve other gods. And the way the Torah words it, the Torah is teaching us that most pagans knew that God was running the world. But they say, well, the sun is ruling the crop, so we should serve the sun a little bit. The moon is taking care of the water. The tides go in direct correlation with the moon, so we should serve the moon a little bit. God says, no, you don't serve anyone with me, I'll take care of you. And this is the prohibition of shituf. People sometimes say, well, shituf, when we have, we believe in God, but we also believe in other beings. No, that is prohibited. There's a discussion whether shituf is considered idol worship for non-Jews. For a Jew, for sure, it's asul. The Torah says, no, here in our parsha. This week is Shabbos Mevarchim. In the coming week is going to be Rosh Chodesh Adar. Rosh Chodesh, the month of Adar, has always been a lucky month for us. And in the month of Adar is always the month before Nisan, right? That's the order of the months. So we would donate new machtzis ha-shekel to the temple. We would each give half of a coin so that all of our donations together would fund the communal sacrifices that were brought daily. We do not have a Beit HaMikdash now. And we lament that fact. We're waiting for it to be rebuilt. We do things to commemorate that. A woman doesn't put on all her jewelry at one time. We don't set the table with the most beautiful vessels at one time. When a person paints his home, he leaves a square enama by enama that's unpainted next to the front doors to remind himself, it's not whole. My happiness is not whole. When a chassan gets married, so he puts a mesh cloth on his forehead. He's in mourning. We mention Aletu Ushalayim al Rosh Simchati. At the peak of our happiness, we mention the fact that Jerusalem is not yet rebuilt. And one of the things that we do in commemoration of the temple is that on this Shabbos, we are going to read the Parsha of Shkalim. We're going to read about the half coins that were donated to the temple in order to fund the communal sacrifices. And in doing this, we're also reminding ourselves to do the act of giving Machtzis HaShekel. Today we do Zecher LeMachtzis HaShekel. We commemorate that half coin. And we give a donation in commemoration of that half coin. All of you guys should make sure to do that. Sometimes people do it on Tanis Esther. Very often they put out boxes and everyone gives their half coins to the Machtzis HaShekel over there. But all of this is a commemoration of what was in the time of the temple. And we should merit Be'ezrat Hashem that it should be rebuilt speedily. Shabbat Shalom.